Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I hope everyone had a lovely Father's Day.
Yeah, what did you do for your father, Larry Proft?
Watched the U.S. Open. And so that's what you do.
One of the things you do. Wait, did you watch it with him, or you watched it in honor of him? He was in his house. You were in your little pie in the sky.
Yeah.
That's how that goes?
A combination of the two. And so...
what did you think of the U.S. Open?
And did you play golf with your dad, since he plays 365 days a year?
Did not play with him. You know why? Because he's smart enough to know you never play on the weekends. And especially on Father's Day.
Amateur hour.
Yeah. And he doesn't deal with that. You know, he likes to get up early, get in his 18 holes, possibly 72 holes, and then goes home and takes a little nappy noopy. He's got a nice life.
It's not bad.
But yeah, I watched the U.S. Open, though. That was...
Oh, you did?
Oh, my gosh. It was insane. Because, well, I'm always interested. I call the PGA Open.
The PGA Open. That's what you termed it on Thursday, I believe.
But I loved on Saturday how everybody's complaining about the pin placement, and everybody was, you know, one over, two over, when you're normally, you know, five under.
One over, two over, or Ricky Fowler shot 84.
Ooh.
Or Phil shot 81 or 82.
Well, he was a hot mess. What was the hole where the ball's rolling and he ran up to it and tried to stop it and knock it in the cup? I've never seen that before, have you?
I've never seen that in a professional tournament. No. I've never seen that in U.S. Open.
I don't even do that.
That was not Phil's finest moment.
No, it was a desperation shot. Come back here, little ball. I'm going to get you.
But here's the thing. It's actually a classic case, too, of making things worse by trying to spin your way out of it rather than just cop to it. His explanation is what made it worse. His explanation that it was strategic, that he was, you know, in the midst of going back and forth on these greens that wouldn't hold a putt, much less an approach shot. And so rather than have the ball go all the way down 40 yards from the apron of the green, he just went back and hit it, take the two-stroke penalty.
He ended up with 10 on that hole.
Right.
That's bad. If you get more than a snowman, it's over, which is an 8.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Golf tips. Golf scoring.
Golf scoring. Never get more than a snowman.
But here's the thing. Actually, if he was being strategic, if that was well thought out or a strategic reaction in the moment, he could have just declared the ball unplayable and placed it with two club lengths. So it doesn't really hold water. Nobody really believed it, and it sort of made Phil, you know, I mean, it just sort of was a tarnishing event for Phil, and this is one of the all-time greats.
Well, they changed the pin placement on Sunday, so it would be fair, according to the players. But I could not get over the crowd. They should never have a U.S. Open ever in New York. Did you hear the New Yorkers? Like, hey, well, how's your wife? People, they were taunting players. They're asking Brooks Koepka, who ended up winning, how's your wrist? You know, I mean, they were just there. And who's that? Tony Finau.
And asked him how his ankle was.
Right. How's your ankle?
Because he, of course, dislocated his ankle during the Masters.
Yeah, right. That par 3 competition. He was celebrating, popped it out, then popped it back in, and I got sick. But I just think that they are too obnoxious. We need to have a more refined crowd, such as Chicagoans.
Mm-hmm.
Or anywhere in the Midwest.
Well, move over Curtis Strange, Brooks Koepka.
Back to back,
first time in 3 decades.
And he's a big dude. He looks like a linebacker, you know? I mean, he's buff. Oh, I can't. Too much?
Take it easy over there. Yeah, he'll send you an autographed picture. Just send him a letter.
Fine.
You'll get an autographed picture for the home.
Thanks.
Yeah.
No, I'm hanging up here in the studio.
I know not everybody likes golf, but everybody should, and everybody should watch the U.S. Open and the Masters each summer. And so
Condi Rice does.
That's what I did.
Yeah. Oh, did you golf?
Condi Rice doesn't what?
She plays golf and watches the Masters. And
she's a member at Augusta.
Yeah, she is.
Right.
Uh-huh. Did you play this weekend?
I did not, no.
Why? Because what?
Didn't get around to it. Plus,
because you had Medina, and then you had our golf tournament on Thursday. That led into Friday, because it lasted 7.5 hours.
Try and get around. Actually, this year, our golf outing, which, of course, the afternoon round, my team won. Our golf outing wasn't that bad.
Right. Yeah.
It wasn't that bad this year.
No, it wasn't.
It was like 5.5 hours, which is not terrible for two groups per hole. So, actually, it seemed like it moved around a little more quickly, but I had a good group, too.
Well, are you and Desmond Clark BFFs now?
Yeah, me and Des.
I'm sorry. Yeah, now you call him Des.
Yeah.
Okay. He told some fascinating stories about some players.
It was fun.
Wow.
He's a really good guy. It was fun
I
to play
him.
With him. Speaking of Father's Day, a couple of Father's Day notes. I don't know if you've got one of these collector's items, but if you did get a baby daddy card, you're going to want to keep that because Target is discontinuing carrying them in their stores.
A baby daddy card?
Yeah. Baby daddy? You're familiar with this term? It's been around
for a minute.
They
have cards for that?
Yeah. The card said baby daddy in pink cursive script and featured a black couple kissing. That generated some market feedback from Target.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
Interestingly, a woman who brought this to the attention of Target a couple months earlier in Dallas said she was said that was the only card she was that she saw that had a black couple on it as she was looking for a card to give to her husband that reflects her own family. She is, you know, by definition of saying her husband, she is married. My reaction was just, this is my only option. I don't view him as my baby daddy. I would not call him that. That's offensive to him and me. Right. Target said, we really do appreciate the opportunity to get feedback from our guests. And it's never our intent to offend customers. So American Greetings instructed other retailers to remove it from thousands of other stores across the country as well.
Well, I spent Father's Day too. CNN had a great piece. Are you ready for this? This is the title. He gave birth. He breastfed. Now he wants his son to see him as a man. It's about a biological female. Remember, she reversed herself to a transgender man who, after taking testosterone, conceived a child with a man who was also transitioning into a transgender woman, but stopped taking hormones long enough they could conceive a son.
I'm going to need a scorecard on that.
I mean, but here's a picture of it. That was how they celebrated Father's Day with this wonderfully messed up story about this poor kid who has two transgender parents who, when it was convenient for them to be their biological gender, conceived and then transitioned back.
They transitioned to conceive and then transitioned back.
Yeah, it makes your head spin, and we should not promote this craziness.
So they're just playing man and woman when they
going
back and forth. I see. Mm-hmm.
That's
a good example of fatherhood in the modern era, I suppose. Here's another example. This is sort of writ large, the data. The first American celebration of Father's Day commemorated a mining accident that left more than 1,000 children fatherless. This was in the early 1900s. At that point, less than 10% of kids under the age of 10 lived in a household, not including their biological or adoptive father. Today, that number's nearly 25%. Also, of course, the primary driver of the increase in fatherless homes is not mortality issues. It's incarceration and less marriage.
Hence the card at Target.
Yeah, well, it's true. Now, the company did say it was intended to be a playful husband card, but we've notified the product team that it missed the mark. Okay. It missed the mark because it's too close to home, ironically. The share of kids living apart from their dads by race, 57% of African Americans, 28% for Hispanics, 16% for non-Hispanic whites, 10% for Asians. And one reason, of course, is that African Americans as a group are more likely to be incarcerated, but that's only one reason. So the problem of incarceration, less marriage, it's across racial demographics in terms of the substantial increase over the last century, but it's most notable in communities that, by the economic data, are struggling the most. I wonder if there's a connection.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
And Amy, and if you were at the Stormy Daniels limited performance on Thursday night, give us a call, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, so that we can shame you.
Well, no, I mean, she was supposed to perform Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and what happened?
She performed Thursday night, and there was a...
Did something happen?
There was a dispute over certain details in the contract. She performed Thursday night, started about an hour late, was around for about 15 minutes. Most of the $30 to $50 tickets for the show sold out. The Thursday night crowd is described by the Tribune as spirited. Yes. Filled with people who seem to be attending a strip club for the first time.
Oh, okay.
A few men near the stage, near the front of the stage, wore Make America Great Again hats on sale in the lobby. Oh, sure, they want to get it from both sides, like Stormy Daniels. And another man gave Daniels repeated standing ovations, and he also clapped for her as she stripped off her red, white, and blue sparkly costume to songs like American Woman and American Girl. You're sorry you missed that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. So she just danced around a pole scantily clad.
Yes. Yeah, so
because that's what strippers do.
Correct. Yes. The problem, though, why the run was shortened just Thursday and then she took off.
I knew people that were supposed to go Friday, but what happened?
Of course you did. No, well, of course. It's a nice Friday night, date night. her assistant, Stormy Daniels' assistant, Dwayne Crawford, told the Tribune Friday afternoon that the Admiral had a little man that management wanted to pop out of an onstage cake as Trump, and Stormy Daniels wasn't having it because she has standards.
Oh, so was it a little like...
A midget.
Midget.
Yeah,
midget
Trump out of a cake.
Who resembled President Trump to jump out of a cake.
We avoid political situations with our shows because we're in the middle of a lawsuit. Very careful.
Mm-hmm.
Also, for security purposes, Daniel's team has a very specific way of handling meet and greets and retains all merchandise profits, something that also was apparently an area of disagreement between the management of Stormy Daniels and the management of Admiral Theater.
Wow.
And now I need to take another shower this morning.
The storm pattered out in Chicago.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5, on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The big question in D.C., one of the big questions, why is Peter Strzok still at the FBI?
I know.
How does this guy keep his job?
How does this happen?
This is one of the reasons. He's a good example of why there's such frustration with the political ruling class. It seems not only are people not held to account, they continue to enjoy benefits of their own malfeasance. It's bizarre. Just so we're clear again, the Inspector General's report, which we spent a lot of time Friday going over, that basically details lack of impartiality, insubordination, intimidation of the FBI by Hillary's lawyers.
But no political bias.
Well, that's, of course, that's the left spin. But, of course, that's not what Michael Horowitz's report says at all. For example, on Peter Strzok, that his texts, not only indicative of a biased state of mind, but even more seriously, implying a willingness to take official action to impact the presidential candidate's electoral prospects. The text messages, Horowitz goes on, quoting, potentially indicated or created the appearance that the investigative decisions were impacted by bias or improper considerations. Now, Horowitz is painstakingly detailed in his assessment. Can't prove it. He's telling you what they indicate, which is, oh, by the way, why Horowitz referred his findings on Strzok to the FBI's Office of Professional Responsibility for Possible Disciplinary disciplinary measures. The IG explicitly considered a scenario in which Strzok slow walked the investigation into Anthony Weiner's laptop because he was leery of doing something to hurt Hillary's chances in the final weeks of the campaign.
But what struck me as so strange is James Comey didn't even know that Anthony Weiner was married to Huma Abedin.
He can't keep up with the tabloids.
But even Peyton and Eli know that. Who doesn't know that? President Clinton married them. She's Hillary's best friend. They're connected at the hip.
That's just how apolitical Comey is.
Oh,
he doesn't pay attention to these things.
I mean, do you think he's just aloof, stupid, cocky? 312-642-5600 is our Turnkey Debt Pro answer line. 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I think he's done. And Trey Gowdy made this point over the weekend. He was on with Maria Bartiromo. There was Chris Wallace.
They kind of look the same.
There was this meeting on Friday. You know, in the wake of this, you know, Trey Gowdy went from someone very much inclined to give the FBI and DOJ the benefit of the doubt.
Yep,
right? These are institutions he wants to see protected. He understands their importance. And I think most Americans do, too. But they also want them to be run by political operatives, which is apparently what was happening during the Obama administration and into the Trump administration until there were some personnel changes. And apparently more personnel changes need to be made. But Gowdy and Devin Nunes, House Intel Committee Chairman, Speaker Ryan, Christopher Wray, and DOJ, Friday night meeting. You are going to comply with these subpoenas for the documents that have been subpoenaed. Mm-hmm. You're going to do it this week, or we're going to move in unison as a caucus in the House to impose the disciplinary actions on the relevant parties that are available to us. Here's Trey Gowdy making the case and also with something about Comey standing as the star witness given this IG report.
We had a meeting Friday night under the heading of Minor Miracles. You had members of the House working on a Friday night. Paul Ryan led this meeting. You had Devin Nunes, Bob Goodlatte, myself, and everyone you can think of from the FBI and the DOJ. And we went item by item on both of those outstanding subpoenas. We either have compliance, we have partial compliance, or we have non-compliance. And Paul made it very clear. There's going to be action on the floor of the House this week if the FBI and DOJ do not comply with our subpoena request. So Rod Rosenstein, Chris Wray, you were in the meeting. You understood him just as clearly as I did. We're going to get compliance, or the House of Representatives is going to use its full arsenal of constitutional weapons to gain. Part of that depends upon what you view the Mueller probe as. Now, you mentioned collusion. The only person in the universe who claims to have evidence of collusion is Adam Schiff. And unlike any other secret he's ever had, he's actually kept this one. He's never told anyone what evidence he has. So there's no evidence of collusion, obstruction of justice. Chris, good luck having your star witness being Jim Comey in any prosecution from shoplifting to obstruction of justice. Good luck if that.
Yeah, good luck. So that's his review. Devin Nunes, who was on with Maria Bartiromo over the weekend, echoed Gowdy's sentiments and was a little bit more specific.
The deadline's not Friday. The deadline is this week. So if documents do not begin to be turned over tomorrow, And a clear way and path forward for everything else is not clear here in the next couple days, there's going to be hell to pay by Wednesday morning, because, you know, we can no longer, it's not just about the committee chairman any longer. This is about a rank and file members of Congress who continue to come up to me and say, what on earth are you guys doing? I have many members on the Intelligence Committee that are Republicans that are trying to get to the bottom of these issues. They're relying on me to get the documents so that they can complete the investigation that we began. So we are quickly, this is going to go from just myself and a few committee chairmen to all the members of the House of Representatives who are going to begin to take action against the Department of Justice and FBI.
And the action, he said, included a number of options that Congress has at its disposal, but most notably impeachment. Remember, we talked a few weeks ago that the telegraphing the prospect of impeaching Rod Rosenstein, for example.
Right.
That's on the table.
All I know from reading that report is I have absolutely zero trust left in the DOJ or the FBI. And Comey, he made up his decision on Hillary in the spring of 2016. Remember, he did the announcement July 5th of 2016. He's a fraud, and he's a glory hound. And that is it. That's all you can say about him. Honestly, I just want him to go away.
Craig,
and I'm not going to read his book or buy his book.
A higher loyalty. Craig in Mount Greenwood has something more to say about Comey.
I'm the second Comey.
Hey, good morning, Dan, Amy. Yeah, these guys, well, starting with Comey, who you were asking about, it's so clear by the report and all the different things that he's said and done over this amount of time. He's exposed as an absolute con artist. He's a dishonest, a liar. But what's going on here is the longer they drag their feet and they take and obstruct like this, I'm talking about like Rosenstein and that, they're all being exposed, really. Rod Rosenstein, Mueller, they're all in this. It really is a rotten cabal of them. Even at the Ray that got out there and that. This is they need to figure out a way to deal with the whole bunch of them. You could never have any confidence in this FBI or Department of Justice with these people. They are so corrupt, and that report, it exposes so many different things that whether they properly go after them, like they went after Flynn and Manafort and all that kind of thing, everything happening so darn fast,
yeah,
and so aggressive, and nothing happened to these other people, these people that are involved. They're supposed to be upholding laws and justice and that, and they do just the opposite.
Thanks for the call, Craig. I mean, you've got a number of points there, though, too. You're talking about, we make this point, senior leadership, but this is, you know, the executive executives responsible for the direction of the agency, how the agency operates. And you're talking about the director. Obviously, we know the hot water, the former deputy director, Andy McCabe, is in. You've got Strzok and Page, as well as agents 1 through 5 unnamed in the report. You have at DOJ, Bruce Orr, deputy attorney general, his wife working on the fusion dossier. You've got Rod Rosenstein, who certainly has been vindicated along with Trump in terms of the rationale for writing the letter in Rosenstein's case, making the decision to fire Comey in President Trump's case.
And then don't you have an FBI agent who asked, they wanted their son to work on the Hillary campaign? It was one of those unnamed agents, 1 through 5, that had asked, you know, I want to get my son a job with her.
That was Strzok.
Yeah. He's a busy guy. Trying to help out his son. Unbelievable.
You also had another deputy attorney general or assistant attorney general who was leaking information to the Hillary campaign. Yeah. So there's a real problem here, and I think Trey Gowdy senses it. Because just to reiterate, I don't think Americans are saying shut down the Department of Justice or shut down the FBI. Some may be saying shut down the FBI.
Well, they could start with getting rid of the bad characters, like Peter Strzok and Page.
Well, that's right. And so to that end, you have Trey Gowdy and Devin Nunes and Speaker Ryan amping this up and saying, we are going to hold you accountable. We're going to take a very public posture in holding you accountable. And my suggestion is, even though some on the left will decry this as somehow meddling or thuggery or whatever, is that Trump should enlist, especially after they comply with the subpoenas or not, but hopefully they will, enlist Ray and enlist Sessions and Rosenstein if they're going to stay and make a very public showing, take a very active role in saying, we're going to work together to make sure that the culture that was poisoned by Comey and Loretta Lynch and those senior leaders, some of the names I mentioned and others, we're going to make sure that people are replaced so the culture is changed and the credibility is restored to these institutions that are so important to law enforcement, to the rule of law in this country. And I think that would be a really interesting position for Trump to take, because it would confound his critics yet again. Then you would have Trump, the institution builder, Trump taking an active role in working with law enforcement, and he's a law and order guy, to restore the credibility of law enforcement. Just a thought. Bruno in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, this American is saying get rid of the FBI, or at the very least, break it down to bare bones and rebuild it from the bottom up, because I don't think it's capable of reforming itself. It's too rotten and corrupt to the core.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bruno. Appreciate it. Pete in Montgomery.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. So where does the DOJ or the IG report come in on the underlying crime of Hillary Clinton mishandling classified information? I mean, that's what this is all this is supposed to be all about.
Well, right. And remember, so Horowitz is really looking at how the FBI handled its responsibilities. He's not making an assessment of the evidence. And so he's obviously rebuked Jim Comey for insubordination. He's rebuked these agents for the at least the appearance of bias, even though he couldn't prove it. So it's a pretty devastating report for the FBI, but he just didn't handle, and it wasn't his job to handle an assessment of the evidence against Hillary.
Thanks. Until that's addressed, the FBI is going to be under a cloud.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Thanks, Pete.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Is President Trump overplaying his hand when it comes to zero tolerance policy on illegal immigration? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. You heard that at the top of the news at the top of the hour that this sort of bubbled over the weekend. And you've got immigration bills that are going to be taken up by House Republicans this week.
Yeah, there's two separate bills, a conservative bill and a moderate bill.
Right. And the more conservative bill, although both arguably cover in different ways the four tenets of Trump immigration reform. Mike McCall, who's chairman of Homeland Security Committee, was on with Maria Bartiromo over the weekend to talk a little bit about what's going to happen this week in the House.
The president is fully committed to both of these bills. He's put the full weight of his office behind it. You know, the McCall-Goodlatte bill, they both, I would say, provide the four pillars that I discussed with the president at that sort of famous roundtable discussion. Most importantly, from my perspective, Maria, it's got border security in there. It's got funding for the wall the president really wants. It's got the technology and boots on the ground. And the four pillars being ending chain migration, ending this random visa lottery system, providing border security, and a DACA solution. So I think, obviously, I'd like to see the McCall-Goodlatte pass on the floor, and we wouldn't have to get to a second bill. But if it gets to that point, I do think this is a historic opportunity to advance a conservative agenda that we've been trying to do for the last 25 years to structurally change the way we do immigration.
And so the question is, does this potentially, or will this potentially be undermined by the controversy surrounding separating parents from their children who enter this country illegally? Of which it's reported some 2,000 minors taken from their parents between April 19th and the end of May, according to Department of Homeland Security.
It's barbaric. I mean, Laura Bush, former First Lady, wrote a really well-thought op-ed in the Washington Post where she said she's heartbroken. She said our government should not be in the business of warehousing children in converted box stores or making plans to place them in tent cities in the desert outside of El Paso. She compared the images are reminiscent of Japanese-American internment camps of World War II. In El Paso, they set up tents that are air-conditioned, but the kids don't have blankets. They have those Mylar blankets, which, you know, you see after a marathon, people wrap themselves in that. There are 100 kids who are 4 years old and younger who don't have their parents. They don't know where their parents are. And Laura Bush, in her article, went on to say that even people that are there, social workers that are there, are told not to comfort or touch the children. I don't understand. And President Trump has been blaming this on the Democrats.
I certainly wouldn't have signed the Momodic.
What does the bill have to have
need, in it? I need a bill that gives this country tremendous border security. I have to have that. We have to get rid of catch and release.
Does that mean the wall?
We have to have the wall. If we don't have the wall, there's no bill.
No, I hate it. I hate the children being taken away. The Democrats have to change their law. That's their law.
It's not their law. It's his law. It's the zero tolerance policy. Before, when you crossed illegally into this country, it was a civil disobedience, but now it's a crime. Oh, I'm sorry, a civil offense, but now it's criminal. That's why parents are being separated from their children.
Point of order, coming into this country illegally is a crime.
Okay, but it was treated in the past as a civil offense, not as a criminal offense. That's why parents are being separated from their children. They're converting, it's an old, you know, Walmart in McLean, Texas, that they converted into this, you know, camp where they have four separate pods where girls 17 and younger stay, the boys. And then they try to keep some family members together, especially the kids in diapers. But even some of them are being separated.
Kristen Nielsen, who's the Secretary of Homeland Security, responded to the press coverage of this, saying on Twitter, "As I've said many times before, if you're seeking asylum for your family, there's no reason to break the law and illegally cross between ports of entry. For those seeking asylum at ports of entry, we have continued the policy from previous administrations, and we'll only separate if the child is in danger, there's no custodial relationship between family members, quote unquote, or if the adult has broken a law." She suggests that they're misreporting, as the press and, of course, the Democrats, the policy. Splitting family units only applies to some cases where immigrants try to come to the U.S. Between standard ports of entry as opposed to the ports of entry and seek asylum, as she just outlined.
Well, Steve Bannon was defending President Trump and said that this is a good policy.
The president is enforcing a zero tolerance policy. We've got to get security on the southern border. He has not been given his wall, and I believe he's going to enforce this policy.
And I just, as a mom, if I knew that this policy existed, that if I had to flee my country and enter into another country, if I knew my kids would be separated from me,
flee.
Or if I was seeking a better life, I would never come into this country illegally.
Flee and seeking a better life are not synonyms. Those are not synonymous statements.
If
had to flee, go to a standard port of entry and seek asylum.
Right. But even people that are seeking asylum are being separated from their kids.
Yeah, well, that's a point of contention. Here's the thing, because I've said this before, and I know there's kind of this rush to just feed into the emotion of a particular case. When you don't enforce the law, when it is arbitrary and capricious, when an entire country loses faith in the rule of law as it pertains to border security, as well as in other realms, but let's focus on border security here, then there is not going to be much sympathy for the consequences that are visited upon people by people who refuse to enforce the rule of law. So I'm not so terribly interested in talking about eliminating the cap on H-1B visas, which I would otherwise philosophically be supportive of. Until you do the things you said you were going to do, this is a nation that cannot even eject convicted criminal illegal aliens without having them come back to this country repeatedly or stay here after they're released from prison. We're talking about violent criminals in addition to breaking the law
by
coming here illegally.
Is making process. They are making process with people who are here illegally.
Making process?
I mean, making progress. Excuse me.
Well, no. Until there is a legal regime with respect to immigration that is sensible, that covers those four pillars that Mike McCall talked about, that the president has talked about, and that accomplishes the simple task that every Democrat says they're supportive of and every Republican says they're supportive of, ejecting people from this country who have preyed on other people, whether they be American citizens or other people here illegally, ejecting violent criminals. We are not doing it.
No, but shouldn't we govern with a heart? I mean, these kids are living. There's 20 kids in a kennel in Brownsville, Texas.
There is no rule of law if it's not enforced.
Well, Senator Jeff Merkley went in. Actually, I'm talking yet. Okay.
So tell Kate Steinle's dad about governing with a heart.
Dan,
no, no, these kids don't
don't have their parents. They're horrified, and the social workers that are there can't comfort them.
If you want to play the heartstrings game, you can't play it in one direction. So what do you tell Kate Steinle's dad about governing with a heart? What do you tell Brian McCann on the South Side about his brother Denny and governing with a heart? What do you tell all of the families in this country who've been victimized by people who shouldn't be here, and everyone agrees they shouldn't be here, and the Democrats don't want to do anything about it. They don't want to do anything about it so much so, governing with a heart, that they won't take Trump up on his offer to double, more than double, the eligible DACA designees as it pertains to permanent status. So you want to play the governing with a heart game, we can play that game,
well,
but you got to play it in every direction.
But why are we using kids as political
pawns?
We're
not using kids as political pawns. The Democrats are, because they won't come to the table on reforming immigration, even consistent with the reforms they say they want. Will they? Where are they on DACA designations, permanent status for DACA recipients? The president wants to do it. I'll see your 800,000. I'll raise you 1 million. 1.8 million. Where are they? Because they won't fund a wall. Because they're not serious about ending chain migration. Because they don't want to talk about the diversity visa lottery. Because they don't want to talk about doing anything substantive other than waving the flag on this issue with respect to violent criminals here illegally.
So all the Democratic politicians who have come forward, this is their fault.
It's Father's Day, damn it. And you have a right to talk to your children. And you don't even know where your children are.
Yawn. Yemi on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Okay, Amy, I know you're emotional right now. Okay, and Laura Bush, when, during their own tenure, that was when my parents were filing for me legally, right? They went emotional for 10 years for me to be in this country. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to be emotional about the legal immigration. So it's going to be illegal, right? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Yemi. Appreciate it. That's the whole other category of people that we just dismiss. We don't talk about the people that are going through the process and waiting, I think, too long in most cases where they've been clearly vetted, waiting too long to gain entry into this country, waiting too long to taking a process that's too long to become a naturalized citizen. I'm all for people coming to this country. I'm not all for this willy-nilly process that we have now where it's just based on the whims of whoever the political power structure is at the moment. That's nonsense. And there's nothing compassionate about it, by the way. Jordan in Forest Park.
Yes, good morning. You know, there's basically three pillars to dealing with this whole thing. Number one, which I haven't heard Trump even talk about, are employer sanctions for hiring people that are here illegally. Number two, you got to do something about the border security, obviously.
E-verify
it. You got to remove all incentives for people that are some family in El Salvador says, let's go to the U.S. because we'll get XYZ or whatever. And you've got to deal with all of those three things. This is the same thing that Barbara Jordan talked about, 20 years ago. And still, the Republicans or the Democrats, they've never dealt with all three of those items.
Well, thanks for the call, Jordan, but that's not exactly correct. Number one, E-Verify is in the McCall-Goodlatte bill. Number two, with respect to the incentives, I agree with that. And I think that maybe this is a separate piece of legislation. I've said for years and years and years, you want to provide a glide path for productive people who want to come into this country, sign away access to welfare state benefits. There's nothing constitutional about them. And that's a way to expedite your processing into this country. Yeah. I will not access the welfare state.
Yeah, that's, I understand and I agree that our immigration system isn't working, but I do not like the fact that kids, especially some that are still in diapers, are being separated from their families.
Nobody
likes that.
If they
kept them all together, well, let's be more humane and keep them together. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, if...
And in McAllen, Texas, there are 11,000 people, or 1,100 people, excuse me, in that box store, that old Walmart, and they have four social workers.
So let me ask you a question. So the person who's come to this country illegally with their children has broken the law, right?
Yes.
Right. A person who...
Can't we just send them back?
A person who robs a convenience store, well, we can, but there's a process. There's a process. Otherwise, the ACLU will be on the other side of that you're illegally deporting them. A person who robs a convenience store has broken the law, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the person who robs a convenience store because he's a mother or father, should he be separated from his children?
Well, he would be separated from his children because he'd be going to jail.
Right. Do you see the comparison?
Yeah, but there are some that are seeking asylum here because one woman they featured, you know, on BEZ, one woman, she said that was beaten repeatedly by her drug dealer boyfriend, so or the father of her child, so she's escaped to the U.S.
Right, but if you don't come through a standard port of entry, then you know, you're going to make things more difficult on yourself because of exactly what the Homeland Security Secretary said.
So you have to go to a point of entry, fill out that you're seeking asylum papers.
Right.
And then hopefully you still won't be separated from your kids.
Well, or but at least then you're following a process. You're either granted asylum or you're not. And then you return to your home country with your family intact, or you stay here with your family intact.
All of the kids that are being held in Brownsville, McLean, and El Paso get 2 hours outside a day. They do get 3 square meals, and some sleep on the floor, some sleep on mattresses that are on the floor, and some sleep in beds.
Alex in West Dundee.
Yeah, these poor kids are probably getting better care where they're at now than if they were in Mexico with their parents. But once again, don't blame the parents who are bringing them here illegally. Everybody gets emotional and wants to change the laws. The parents are to blame for coming here illegally. And then we're enforcing the law, and then they get the kids on TV, and everybody's got to get emotional. And now we're going to change the law just because there's a couple kids. They're probably eating McDonald's and having a good time, like the rest of the kids in America. Probably got Xboxes already, too.
No.
I wouldn't feel too bad for them.
Thanks for the call, Alex.
Alex, why don't you, learn something and go on, or maybe even watch the news and see where these kids are being housed. I don't see any toys. I see them in cages. 20 of them are in a kennel, and then they let them outside for 2 hours a day.
Yeah,
they do have washrooms. They have portable showers and those tents in El Paso.
20 of them are in a kennel. Are you referring to that picture that has been debunked?
Oh, gosh, no.
Okay, but so we understand that was the policy of the previous administration as well.
Yeah, I understand. I'm just saying that.
So to the point is, what Kristen Nielsen said is true. This is a continuation of policy from previous administrations.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wanted to end. Keep the families together. Then send them home.
Then talk to your friends like Mike Quigley. Paul in New Lenox.
Great show. Dan, you're spot on. Amy, you're really on thin ice because of your emotions. But if the parents entered at a point of entry, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, they entered at a designated point of entry at the border, they would be able to stay with their parents. But because they choose to enter illegally at a different point of entry, that's why they're being separated.
Thanks for the call, Paul.
And I know it's CNN and I know it's ABC News, but they have both featured families that were seeking asylum that filled out the correct paperwork, and they were still separated from their kids.
Barbara in Wilmette.
Hi. I just agree with Dan. I was just going to say that, and that gentleman that just called said, you know, if the parents can't go across, if they're not allowed to go across, you don't leave your child. I'm not going to leave. I wouldn't have ever left my child.
Oh,
I mean, you just don't do that. And Mike Gallagher was saying that last Friday. You know, you don't leave your kids. It's simple. I mean, yeah, they want to come across. You know, I want a lot of things I can't have. So, you know, that's it.
Thanks for the call, Barbara. And here's what's happening. The Democrats see political capital to be gained here. The polling on this, Ipsos poll, Republicans in favor of the zero tolerance policy, 46-32. Meanwhile, only 14% of Democrats surveyed support it, and only 29% of independents. So only a quarter of those surveyed overall support the policy. And the Democrats think if they can gin up enough emotional reaction to it, then they can advance their political interests. Oh, by the way, at the expense of the very children, they say they're rallying to support. It's a big scam. It's a big fraud, and that's what our immigration legal regime has become, and that's why there's the impetus to change it. But it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be without the demagoguery.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Speaking of our friend and brother in sound, Dennis Prager, Prager University released a new video last week featuring Jordan Peterson talking about who educates your children. It's worth a listen. And one of the distillations Jordan Peterson does of higher ed and just education in general in this country in terms of who's in charge, the leftist, postmodernist, cultural Marxist, bigots. There's only two categories of people, two categories of people in this country and thus in charge or not in charge.
You're an exemplar of your race, sex, or sexual preference. You're also either a victim or an oppressor. No wrong can be done by anyone in the former group and no good by the latter. Such ideas of victimization do nothing but justify the use of power and engender intergroup conflict.
And that's what is happening in the Ivy League and Harvard specifically. It's happening all over, but there's a particular lawsuit at Harvard, as well as in K-12 education, and most notably in New York City. You have Asian Americans who have been deemed by these leftist, postmodernist, cultural Marxist bigots to be oppressors, not victims. They're with us whites, according to the likes of Harvard and the Sandinista mayor of New York City, de Blasio. Just to give you a sense of what we're talking about here. At Harvard, Dr. Betsy Nabel, she's the president of the teaching hospital at Harvard Medical School. She made the call to take down its prominent display of past medical legends at Harvard because there are too many white men that are have their portraits up at the hospital.
Oh.
30 portraits have to be taken down because the paintings reinforce that white men are in charge. So you see those white men that were great doctors, apparently, and thus they're profiled in the teaching hospital. Their accomplishments don't matter. All that matters is their gender and their race. The merits of what they did in their lives doesn't matter. Only their race and their gender matter. You get the gist of this? Let me give you another example. This is from a pending lawsuit. Harvard and New York Times reporting on Friday, Harvard consistently rated Asian American applicants lower than others on traits like positive personality, likability, courage, kindness, and being widely respected. This is an analysis of more than 160,000 student records filed Friday by a group representing Asian American students in a lawsuit against the university. Asian Americans scored higher than applicants of any other racial or ethnic group on admissions measures like test scores, grades, extracurricular activities, according to the analysis. But the students' personal ratings significantly dragged down their chances of being admitted. So Harvard is doing an end run around anti-discriminatory policies by essentially pushing down the scores that are conferred for subjective criteria like your personality or your courage or your kindness. So denigrating the personal characteristics of Asian Americans as a group so as to avoid having to admit more on the merits than they would otherwise have to admit. How do you like that? Is that the big, inclusive, tolerant left that we're told exists? How about Mayor de Blasio's plan in New York City? Eliminate the city's specialized high school's admissions test and replace it with the requirement that the top 7% of every middle school in New York City be admitted to a specialized high school. So it essentially eliminates the meritocratic approach, the applications process, for one that is predicated on demographics to the benefit of some minority groups at the expense of other minority groups like Asian Americans who just, as a group, perform better. Is that right? Is that consistent with meritocracy? Is that consistent with colorblindness? Is that consistent with kind of the anti-discriminatory environment in which we would all like to live? Judge people on the merits, on the content of their character? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Yukong Zhao. He is the president of the Asian American Coalition for Education. Mr. Zhao, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
So what is your organization's posture with respect to the lawsuit that's been filed against Harvard, the policy change that Mayor de Blasio in New York City is pushing, as well as just I think what we're starting to understand is more and more universities in particular doing what Harvard is doing, but getting away with it to this point?
Yeah, my organization strongly denounces any form of discrimination, in particularly the attempt to change admission standard, either in college admissions or in the high schools. You know, we are appalled by Harvard, the discrimination evidence, you know, by, committed by Harvard. You know, they not only utilize racial stereotype. Worse on that is they use racial balancing. You know, according to Students for Fair Admission, you know, each year Harvard always use a racial statistic to have like some adjustment, and at the end of like admission process, they try to balance all the student ratio, the different ratios according to last year. This is de facto racial quota, has been banned by the U.S. Supreme Court since 1978. And that's immoral. Another point I want to emphasize, that they have nonsense about Asian American community. Asian American community are hardworking, one of the greatest contributors to this country. We have lowest crime rate. We have highest like marriage stabilities. We, you know, we have a lot of artists, a lot of scientists contributed to the American economic prosperity and engineering, like technology innovation. So that kind of stereotype is totally nonsense.
So what, I mean, besides this lawsuit that was filed in federal court, what else can you do to fight back?
We already filed a complaint in 2015 with the Department of Justice. Department of Justice has started the investigation, and also we are pushing for the overall policy change. I want to mention something. In 2011, the Obama administration issued a policy a guidance regarding college admission. But in that policy guidance, they never emphasize, you know, the ban of racial quota, the ban of using the higher standard against Asian American children, the ban of using the racial stereotype. But that policy more focused on how to, you know, promote racial balancing. You know, they treat people, look at people based on race, by skin color, not by the performance, by their character. So that is wrong. So currently, the policy on college admissions via Obama era's policy. So we want to push that, you know, to be changed. We want to, you know, have policy is color blind and also emphasize real our children's like performance and also character.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Professor, accounting professor at Pace University in New York, said in a piece that Bill McGurn wrote in the Wall Street Journal last week, for years, Asian Americans have been viewed as the model minority, quote unquote, you know, quiet and well-behaved. And it seems like a lot of Asian Americans are quiet no longer because they understand the threat that they're up against with respect to their children and their children's educational future. And that manifested itself in one respect with this protest against de Blasio's policy in New York, where you had 1,000 New Yorkers show up and protest at City Hall a week ago Sunday, and it was mostly Asian Americans. So is part of the approach to be more vocal, too, be more vocal in the political process, be more engaged in the political process, because you've got to hold politicians to account for the policy changes they're advocating to the detriment of, you know, Asian families.
That is correct. I have, immigrant to the U.S. for more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say ever since 2014 and ever since, California introduced SAF5, tried to restore the risk-based college admission in California, ever since that, an Asian-American community have woken up. Basically, we organized a lot of demonstrations and also organized this kind of civil complaint against this kind of racial discrimination. And the week before the demonstration in New York is another good sign. One thing I want to point it out, the New York mayor, de Blasio, actually, his act is a political cover-up because he failed Black and Hispanic community in the public school in New York from grade 3 to 8. The processing rate for Black and Hispanic children is only half as the processing rate of the white and Asian-American children.
Yeah, so
this is pretty much a political cover.
This is a great point, actually, right? You're saying that. So they're scapegoating Asian-Americans for what they have failed to do, big city mayors, the Ivy League even, in terms of educating other groups or the disproportionate performance of other groups or participation in the selective schools or in Ivy League schools by other groups. It's been a failure of the people who are in charge. So they're looking for scapegoats. It's white oppressors or it's Asian American kids who do too well in school.
Exactly. And also another thing, one of the biggest problems in this country is the teachers union. You know, in China, when we had the Cultural Revolution, the Maoists really do not measure anybody's performance. Everybody, based on seniority. Currently, America, the teachers' union promotes this, okay? They don't take measure on, teachers. So in this case, many public schools fail. And then, they don't want to, address the root cause of the public schools, the failure of public schools. They just use Asian American children as a scapegoat for their failure.
All right. He is Mr. Yukong Zhao, who's the president of the Asian American Coalition for Education. Mr. Zhao, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, that one-on-one throwdown between Jimmy Kimmel and Ted Cruz took place over the weekend.
Oh, yeah, it was good. I watched some highlights. Did you see it? Ted Cruz isn't bad. He was a shooting forward in high school, and he still has that skill set. I was very impressed with his jump shot.
Yeah, that must have been some very stylized clips you saw, because while Ted Cruz beat Kimmel...
By 11 points, right?
No, he beat him 11-9.
Oh.
Two-hour one-on-one match. 2 hours to get to 11-9.
That was a fundraiser.
And it was a game to 15, but since neither of them appeared like they were going to get to 15 anytime soon...
So they called it.
Whoever got the two-point, one by two, they called it. Yeah.
So were they playing by one or playing by two? No, they're playing by one.
They're playing by one, and you had to win by two.
Okay.
The Houston Chronicle describing the matchup as a slow-motion car crash of half-court basketball. Kimmel, speaking for both men, said, "We apologize to the game of basketball." Dr. James Naismith, spinning still.
Oh, my gosh.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
It's time for Dan Proft's Parenting Tips.
Whoa!
Dan Proft's Parenting Tips.
Whoa!
Tell your kids to shut up and listen to him.
You're a child.
Still makes me laugh.
Okay, I'm not a father. I recently celebrated Father's Day, but
I sent Happy Father's Day to you, and I went, oh, Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, that's fine. I'm paying it forward. For example, yesterday, my contribution was a little dad humor during the U.S. Open when Tommy Fleetwood shot a U.S. Open record-tying 63 after shooting 78 on Saturday.
Ooh.
I tweeted.
What did you tweet?
After a tough round on Saturday, Tommy Fleetwood told himself, "Don't stop thinking about tomorrow."
Oh, is it so funny?
It's dad humor. It's not funny.
Can we get a snare drum? That's really funny.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Dun-dun-dun.
That's why I'm paying.
Did you get
it
a lot of likes and retweets?
I don't know.
Do people like you on
Twitter?
I don't get
the dopamine hit from the likes and retweets. I assume nobody listens to me. I'm just entertaining myself. Frankly,
that is
care.
Good though.
The dangers of distracted parenting, quote unquote. Technoference, quote unquote. Other quote unquote words invented by psychologists to talk about child development. A very interesting piece by Erica Christakis in The Atlantic on the dangers of distracted parenting. Are you a distracted parent who is negatively impacting your child's development? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Emerging research suggests that a key problem involving child development, more screen-obsessed young children, more than screen-obsessed young children.
It's awful.
No? Wait for it.
Yes.
An underappreciated problem with child development, more than screen-obsessed young children, tuned-out parents.
Oh. Guess what we used to call? Remember Marcus Brown? He's our program director, don't you know?
Sure, I remember.
We used to call it Uncle iPad. Who's watching the kids today? Uncle iPad is.
Well, it's
because
interesting.
Because it's easier, because if kids are, you know, they're growing up with iPads and with iPhones and with all this technology. And it really, if you wanted to get something done, you'd say, here, watch TV. And then that converted, that changed to, here, play with the iPad. Mm-hmm. While I go, not leave the house, but while you do, you know, you do some errands inside your house.
And this is
clean
how
the kitchen, or you make the beds, or you do the laundry.
Right. And this is how you end up with a 30-year-old in your basement. Despite a dramatic increase in the percentage of women in the workforce, mothers today actually spend more time caring for their children than mothers did in the 60s. But the engagement between parent and child is increasingly low quality. Parents are constantly present in their children's lives physically, but they are less emotionally attuned.
Well, there is a digital addiction. I'm not going to ever deny that. But it's gotten to the point where you go to restaurants and the mom pops up the iPhone or the iPad and doesn't have the kid wear headphones. And so everybody's listening to the movie. And that's happened at an airport where I went to this one. I was on a plane sitting in first class, and the lady next to me had her daughter watching a movie without headsets on. And I said, excuse me, your child needs to put on headset. What if all of us on this plane just decided to watch movies without headsets? It's called noise pollution. And as a mother, you need to get headsets on your kid.
Okay,
that is not acceptable.
I don't think you're quite getting the point.
I'm just venting.
Here are things that annoy me.
Mothers and dads should know. And then I said something, and then they gave me the stink eye. And I said, no, I'm right. Put headsets on your kid. And that goes for if you're on a plane, at a restaurant, even waiting in line to board a plane.
So did they?
We don't need to hear your noise.
Did they give you the stink eye and then also try and hi-hat you? Because I'll take the stink eye, but if you try and hi-hat me.
It's a hi-hat me. Okay. No, they put headphones on the
child. Go see Miller's Crossing and you'll find out what the hi-hat is. All right,
back to this.
Yeah.
But kids know.
I'm glad you were able to get that out.
Thank you. I feel better.
You don't
want
to let that fester. The issue is continuous partial attention. It's a condition that's not just harming the adult, it's harming the children. The new parental interaction style can interrupt an ancient emotional cueing system whose hallmark is responsive communication. So, one experiment to bring this to fruition here. 9-month-old babies who received a few hours of Mandarin instruction from a live human could isolate specific phonetic elements in the language, while another group of babies who received the exact same instruction via video could not.
Oh.
And this turns out to be really important, for example, this experiment, because language is the single best predictor of school achievement. Key to strong language skills are those back-and-forth fluent conversations between young children and adults, according to a professor at Temple University in the space. So the problem arises when emotionally resonant adult-child cueing systems, so essential to early learning, is interrupted by a text, for example, or a quick check-in on Instagram. Another example. This study conducted in the Philadelphia area, again by this same Temple University, commenting on the phenomenon, testing the impact of parental cell phone use on child's language learning. 38 mothers and their 2-year-olds were brought into a room. The mothers were then told that they would need to teach their children 2 new words, and were given a phone so that investigators could contact them from another room. When the mothers were interrupted by a call, the child did not learn the words, but otherwise they did. So when mom was focused on the child and teaching them the 2 words, they learned the words. When mom got interrupted by a cell phone and took the call, the kids didn't learn the words. So this is the concern that's raised by technoference, another psychological term, the interference of technology in our lives and specifically here in parenting. We're physically present, thereby often blocking kids' autonomy. So we're doing it kind of all wrong. We're physically present. The helicopter parent that's physically present that wants to, keep the kid in the bubble,
right,
and let them play and explore and develop their autonomy. And then only fitfully emotionally present, where we should be zero focused when it comes to things like conferring language skills.
Are you trying to make me feel guilty?
This is an intervention.
No.
I'm seizing control of Peyton and Eli.
But this is why I'm golfing with them, so that we could have something to do together where we have time in the car, where there's no cell phones, there's nothing, where we could just converse and talk. But it's hard. I mean, when they were kids, when they were 3 and 4 years old, they used to take my cell phone and hide it. I said, what? I need my phone. They're like, no, you need to be with us, Mom. Stop looking at your phone. Stop engaging in your, electronic addiction. Well, they didn't use those words, but they didn't like it. And you see moms doing that all the time, and nannies are always on their phone. So
I'm sorry. I was responding to a text message. I didn't hear you. No, exactly. So a family that throws golf clubs together stays together.
Exactly.
Grows together.
Well, you have to do something together, whether it be, my friend has her whole, they are all certified scuba divers now, so they go on scuba diving vacations.
And this is why Peyton was able to read the diploma that he received on Friday.
Exactly.
All right. There's Prof parenting tip. Physically give them some space, let them develop their autonomy. Emotionally, intellectually,
Eye-to-eye contact.
Yeah, here. Focus, people.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and, I know somebody who broke up with their boyfriend over a poor Uber rating.
Really? What happened?
She saw his Uber rating on his phone, and it was like under 2, and she basically is like, look, if you have a rating that low, that means you're mean to Uber drivers. That means you're a mean person. That means I can't go out with you.
Oh, okay. Well,
what's your Uber rating?
My Uber rating's bad. It is the highest it could be is 5.0, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And mine's really bad. I had an experience this past weekend, and it dropped precipitously after my event with this Uber driver. We're going to Peyton's graduation party at Blaine, and we are all in the car, and I was trying to charge my phone while we were driving to Belmont and Sheffield.
Using the Uber driver's charger or your charger?
No, using the Uber driver's charger.
Oh, it's a nice amenity he provided.
Right. So I couldn't get it plugged in because of this other case or whatever. So he was trying to do it, and he veered into oncoming traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grabbed the wheel, pulled it back in, and he said that
Jesus can grab the wheel.
And he said that I scratched him because I grabbed the phone. As I moved with the right hand, I steered us right back into the lane, grabbed my phone that he was trying to plug in, and took that back. And he said that I scratched him. And he was complaining, going, looking at it the whole time we were driving there. I'm sitting there. Okay, Sally, really? I didn't break the skin. So before I got out of the car.
So you assaulted an Uber driver.
I wanted to take a picture of it to prove, just in case he tried to say that I assaulted him, to show that.
You've just admitted you assaulted him.
No, it was an accident. I was grabbing the phone. I have long nails. I didn't break the skin. There was
no
broken skin. There's no rash. There was no bruising. And he kept going, like looking at like a little pee hat wear.
Okay.
Like, oh, my God, man up, buddy.
All right.
So he wouldn't let me take the picture. Why not? And he said, no, it's fine, whatever. You know, I think he just wanted me to get out of the car.
Most people are concerned about Uber drivers assaulting them. If you have Amy J in your car, it's a little bit of a different story.
But I didn't know, too, that we could tip Uber drivers.
Didn't know.
No, I did
didn't
not
know about the tipping policy. So it's right there. Every time you complete a ride, you get it pops up with a rating, and then if you want to add a tip.
This is new to me. Isn't this? I mean, but so how do I get my Uber rating up? Do I just have to be really pleasant and let them just drive into oncoming traffic?
Yes, that would help. 5-star ratings and tipping.
Well, and then when I.
And like, being pleasant. Don't assault people. Don't scratch them. Don't grab the wheel. They're the driver.
What's your
say
Uber?
Thank you for allowing me to use your charger.
I said that. And that one Uber
driver. It's so funny, you know.
Just braked right on Arlington Heights Road here.
Yeah.
When I remember when I had 2 flat tires, I had an Uber here.
Yeah.
And he did not speak any English, just got to this country, and just threw on the brake, like stopped right in the middle of Arlington Heights Road.
Because
said,
you were
out.
Assaulting him.
No, I was not assaulting him. And I screamed. What are you doing?
Oh, well, that's
you
not going to help
left
your rating.
At the light. Well, yeah, so it's
so
my
rating. It wasn't one incident now, was
well,
it? Yeah.
Well,
one incident
to think
doesn't drive
why.
Your rating down to what's your rating?
It's
you haven't really said.
2.5.
That's low. Yeah.
So do I break up with
going to
myself?
Showcase showdown with that.
So if I just took a bunch of Ubers today and
yeah.
tipped them and smiled and just.
You should spend a few
be
days.
Compliant.
Yeah.
Or should I just get rid of it and get Lyft? And then do they have ratings for Lyft?
Yeah, I assume. I don't know. I don't use Lyft. And that's why I have such a high Uber rating.
What is yours again?
So here's the thing. It's funny about this. Yes. No, it's funny about this because, you know, the rap is Amy's the nice person and Dan's the ogre. He's mean to people. 2.5 Uber rating for Amy Jacobson. 4.88.
What?
For Dan Proft.
Oh, my gosh. Do you just not even say anything to them when you get in the car?
Correct.
You don't say a word.
That's right.
And what about tipping? I bet you're a big tipper.
I say thank you. I'm a perfect gentleman. And that's the secret to getting a high Uber rating.
Wait, how much do you tip? And do you tip cash or do you tip it on
the
phone?
No, I just tip on the phone. Yeah,
really?
It's that easy. It takes 1 second. Maybe if you were a little bit more considerate of others and paid attention to the prompts on the Uber screen, you could... pull yourself up from the depths of 2.5.
How do I recover from this?
I just told you.
Okay, just start tipping and don't say anything.
Or the flip side is you're going to have to become an Uber driver to get a whole new rating. You get a rating on the driver's side. And maybe that's a way to offset the rating on the rider side.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity. Right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And the Department of Justice Inspector General report really puts Democrats in a trick bag on so many levels. One of which is I think they don't know whether they're supposed to like Jim Comey or not anymore.
Right. Nobody knows.
He's Mueller's star witness, ostensibly, in the... obstruction case they're trying to conjure up against President Trump, but he didn't fare too well in that Inspector General report, nor did some of his underlings like Page and Strzok and 5 unnamed agents. Department of Justice doesn't fare particularly well either, going back to the days when Loretta Lynch was the Attorney General. And this has President Trump and House Republicans on offense. Over the weekend, both Trey Gowdy, chairman of the House Oversight, and Devin Nunes, chairman of the House Intel Committee, recounted a meeting that occurred on Friday evening, led by Speaker Ryan, that included Christopher Wray, FBI director, representatives from DOJ, including Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, where they basically said, look, those subpoenas that have been pending for more than a year, you're going to produce those documents. You're going to produce the documents we've requested this week, or we're going to take
action on the floor.
Yeah, the disciplinary action that we have available to us, including but not limited to impeachment. Here's Trey Gowdy laying it out with Chris Wallace on Fox.
We had a meeting Friday night under the heading of Minor Miracles. You had members of the House working on a Friday night. Paul Ryan led this meeting. You had Devin Nunes, Bob Goodlatte, myself, and everyone you can think of from the FBI and the DOJ. And we went item by item on both of those outstanding subpoenas. We either have compliance, we have partial compliance, or we have non-compliance. And Paul made it very clear. There's going to be action on the floor of the House this week if the FBI and DOJ do not comply with our subpoena request. So Rod Rosenstein, Chris Wray, you were in the meeting. You understood him just as clearly as I did. We're going to get compliance, or the House of Representatives is going to use its full arsenal of constitutional weapons to gain. Part of that depends upon what you view the Mueller probe as. Now, you mentioned collusion. The only person in the universe who claims to have evidence of collusion is Adam Schiff. And unlike any other secret he's ever had, he's actually kept this one. He's never told anyone what evidence he has. So there's no evidence of collusion, obstruction of justice. Chris, good luck having your star witness being Jim Comey in any prosecution, from shoplifting to obstruction of justice. Good luck if that's your star witness. For me, the Mueller probe is about what Russia did in 2016 and who, if anyone, they did it with.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by New York Times bestselling author of books on a range of topics, including the Secret Service, the FBI, and the CIA. Most recent offering, the Trump White House, an exclusive access he got with President Trump that informs his book. He is Ronald Kessler. Ronald, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Always great to be with you.
So what about the fallout from that Inspector General report and seems renewed vigor coming from more than just Devin Nunes after that report?
Well, I think they are making progress on getting additional documents out of the FBI. It is, you know, very sensitive when you're talking about an ongoing investigation. If you're talking about a source, you know, whose life could be in danger if his identity were revealed, I think that's what part of this is about. The report itself directed the greatest criticism towards Comey, as you indicated, and in fact, towards the fact that he gave the public statements about Hillary, which actually hurt Hillary as opposed to Trump. It gives Trump ammunition because of the Peter Strzok messages that will stop Trump. But it also says that Strzok said in another message he didn't want to work on the Mueller investigation because he didn't think there was much there. And also that both he and Lisa Page, his lover, were for more aggressive actions in some cases, using more use of subpoenas. So there's quite a jumble of information there. It really pertains to the actions of about a dozen FBI employees, including the director and the deputy director. So it's not a systemic problem within the FBI.
But why would the IG report say that he's not politically biased? When clearly, if you read the report, it sounds like there's some biased behavior going on.
Well, there's clearly he had bias in terms of his personal opinions, but they couldn't identify any decision that resulted from that. In fact, as I mentioned, in some cases he was for more aggressive actions against Hillary. So it's just not, not a black and white situation.
Right. I mean, he says, Horowitz says he couldn't prove it, but he talks about examples of what appear to be bias throughout, and they're obvious and numerous. So, you know, that spin from the left, it just isn't going to hold water, I don't think. One of the questions that comes out of this, though, because the report was so harmful to the FBI's credibility and Department of Justice to a lesser extent, is does this now give Trump the leverage and perhaps the inclination to shut down Mueller?
No, you know, Trump is going to use whatever he can to go after the FBI and undercut his credibility as far as the Mueller probe goes. But there's no way he's going to fire Mueller. You know, he's a lot of his tweeting and statements are to whip up his base. You know, I know I've known him for two decades, and in my book I go into the fact that he's very different when you actually know him, as opposed to his public caricature, and that other Donald Trump is very thoughtful, doesn't make rash decisions. You know, even the decision to fire Comey, you know, which led to the appointment of Mueller, was taken only after Sessions and and Rosenstein said they have no confidence in Comey because of his decision to hold a press conference about Hillary and make the decision on his own not to indict her. So it was not a rash decision, although not very well timed. You know, in my book, The Trump White House, I actually point out that when Trump said he fired Comey and he thought about the Russian, the Russia investigation, he went on to make it clear that he didn't mean that he fired him over the Russia investigation. In fact, quite the opposite. In the next few paragraphs, which of course the media have ignored, he said that he recognized that by firing Comey, it could actually prolong the FBI investigation. He wasn't trying to get rid of the investigation at all. But again, the media, you know, love to ignore the other side.
Well, I want to know why FBI agent Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, how are they still working at the FBI, and why haven't they been fired?
Strzok is.
Lisa Page has left. Oh, I'm quite sure Strzok will be fired, but I think they probably were waiting until the report came out, and you know, there are various procedures internally when it comes to firing someone, but there's no question he's going to be gone, no question.
Yeah, and his attorney this morning has come forward saying that they'll testify before Congress.
Yeah,
That should be fun.
Yeah,
you know, from your relationship with Trump and your discussions with him, I don't know exactly when all these discussions happened, but do you think that Trump has confidence in Christopher Wray? You know, that's his appointee at FBI. Do you think he has confidence that Christopher Wray can restore the credibility of the FBI and essentially sweep out those FBI agents who act more like political operatives?
Yes, I think, you know, he has not criticized Wray at all. He is his appointee, as you say. You know, if you look at Trump's appointments, they're incredible, and that's one example. He's a very reasonable, judicious kind of guy, and is doing a good job at the FBI. There haven't been any problems under him, you know, since he took over. So that's certainly a good sign. You know, the report also said that contrary to a lot of the criticism of the FBI, including by some former agents, the investigation did use a grand jury, did issue 56 subpoenas, you know, didn't put people under oath because the FBI never does that because there's no need to. There's a law that prohibits lying to the FBI, and that's much more easily used in a prosecution. So, you know, it put to rest some of the myths. And I think it's a very truthful report.
Well, yeah, I don't think it put to rest a lot of the questions about the Hillary Clinton investigation and lack of prosecution. I don't think it put that to rest. And I don't think it inspired confidence in the senior leadership of the FBI. People can distinguish between an agency that big at the rank and file level as compared to the senior leadership level. But for me, it was just another stinging indictment of the same cast of characters we've been talking about for a year, starting with Comey.
Yeah, no question. And you know, since Comey came out with his book, I mean, he's turned out to be a total travesty. He said it was possible that Trump was compromised by the Russians. Well, what an incredible thing to say.
Yeah.
It's possible that you know, the neighbor down the street murdered someone. Well, when he was asked by Jake Tapper, well, why do you say that? He said, well, Trump keeps saying that he's innocent. Can you imagine if a juror in a murder trial said, I voted to convict him because he kept saying he's innocent. And he also said he hasn't criticized Putin, which actually was not true. And more recently, he's criticized him more. But beyond that, Trump has taken about 12 different actions, as opposed to words, that are anti-Putin, including sanctions. So Comey, you know, clearly has become a total, well, let's say, just has lost his credibility, if he had any to begin with.
He is Ron Kessler, New York Times bestselling author of many books, Secret Service, FBI, CIA, The Topics. The latest, The Trump White House. He gets unique access to President Trump that informs his books. So you want to pick that up. Ron, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, boy, a disappointing showing, so to speak, from Stormy Daniels over the weekend. You know, her big run at the Admiral Theater ended abruptly after her Thursday night performance.
What happened? I mean, and there's billboards all over Chicago promoting that event. And I know some people that were going to go to Friday night's show.
Of course you do.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Regular script showing patrons?
No, that was their first time because they just wanted to see.
That's what they all say.
What President Trump likes. Mm. If they wanted to see it firsthand.
Well,
that's why they went or tried to go, but it didn't happen.
Thursday night performance started about an hour late.
See, I hate that.
It lasted only about 15 minutes.
Strip club acts should start on time.
You're a stickler about that.
Well, it's a way for them to get more money in the bar sales.
And to your point, according to one Tribune reporter, most of the $30 to $50 tickets for the show sold out. The Thursday night crowd was spirited. Of course they were. Filled with people who seemed to be attending a strip joint for the first time. Apparently, Morgan Green, who is this reporter, is a veteran of attending strip joints. They could make that determination. That's interesting. But here's what happened. Well, first, just a little bit more color there, in case you missed it. I mean, if you did attend, please do give us a call, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Or text us, too. I mean, right. We need to know, 64636, DA, quick comment.
We need to know so we can tell your wife on
We need to break this down.
A few men near the front of the stage wore MAGA hats on sale in the lobby. Another man gave Daniels repeated standing ovations, and he also clapped, as she stripped off her red, white, and blue sparkly costume to songs like American Woman.
Oh.
But here's the rub.
Hey.
There was a dispute between her representation and the Admiral Theater's management because...
Brown M&Ms?
No, we're not a green room.
Green room?
Well, sort of. It wasn't like a brown or green M&M issue. It was a midget popping out of a cake as Donald Trump issue. And you know how temperamental theater folk are.
That's awesome.
Her assistant, Stormy's assistant, said, we're not having it. We avoid political situations with the shows because we're in the middle of a lawsuit. So no little man dressed up as Trump jumping out of a cake. And then there was also some arguments about merchandise profits and whatnot. Imagine that. Imagine her renegotiating after the fact. The show did not go on with Stormy Daniels. But then I understand for the Friday to Sunday shows, Elon Musk is her understudy. He filled in as the whore at the Admiral.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Is Trump Hitler? Is his zero-tolerance immigration policy reminiscent of Nazi Germany? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'm just repeating what men and women of the left are saying, are they not?
Well, yeah, and leading the charge is ex-CIA Chief General Michael Hayden. He tweeted out a picture of Auschwitz and compared Trump's immigration policy to Nazi Germany with a quote, "We need to be careful." And they're saying that because currently this morning, as you're waking up, there's still 2,000 children in these certain detention camps, or well, I don't even want to know what you call them. There's in El Paso, they made a tent city. Each tent is air conditioned. They're providing food, water. Kids can only leave for 2 hours a day. And then there's one in Brownsville and there's one in McAllen, Texas. And there are reports, the one in McAllen, Texas, There are 20 kids in a kennel-like situation where they're gated in. Mm-hmm. A little more humane in Brownsville, Texas, where they changed the big box store, an old Walmart, into a housing station. But they separate the girls that are 17 and younger in one pod, the boys in another pod, children in one pod, and then the men and women in a separate pod. Mm-hmm. So why can't they just keep these groups together? Even Kellyanne Conway, mother herself, Catholic, she was on Meet the Press and had this to say.
As a mother, as a Catholic, as somebody who's got a conscience, I will tell you that nobody likes this policy. You saw the president on camera that he wants this to end.
But then he could change it. I mean, this zero tolerance policy, that's why people are being housed in these detention centers, because it used to be a civil crime to cross the border. And now it's...
I don't know why you keep saying that. Crossing the border is illegal. It's a criminal offense. Crossing the border in this country is illegal. It is illegal to illegally enter this country.
I understand, but they have not separated the children and the parents before. That's what they're doing now. That's why they're opening up all, you know, the old big box stores to house these people.
Well,
so it was a civil offense. You got a court date. You had to come back, and a lot of people didn't come back by court date.
I'm sorry. By definition, are not DACA arrivals often separated from their parents?
Not that.
Yeah. The answer is yes.
I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, then you're not aware. The
well,
answer is
there's
yes.
100 kids that are 4 years and young, 4 years old and younger that don't have parents, and the social workers that are there are told not to comfort them when they're crying.
So
they can change their diapers, but then they can't soothe them and love them.
So what should be done, do you think?
I think that they should keep the families together in these detention centers, because some people are in different centers. One's in Brownsville, one's in McAllen. And they can't even communicate with their kids.
So then should we do a catch and release, or should we allow them into the country, or what should we do?
Well, if they're seeking asylum, they have to go to a port of entry and file paperwork.
And the reason they've been separated, those
people are being separated from their kids, though.
Kristen Nielsen, who's the Department of Homeland Security Secretary, suggested that the policy is being misreported, as well as the actions of Homeland Security and Border Enforcement, that you have asylum seekers who are not going to designated ports of entry and thus are attempting to enter illegally, where if they go to designated ports of entry, then you can seek asylum, file the paperwork, and there's not the separation. I know there's reported individual cases of separation despite that protocol. I don't know the veracity of those specifically. I'm just telling you what the Department of Homeland Security's policy is. In addition to that, the question becomes, if you're entering this country illegally, what should be done? Should we just do catch and release, or should we, process people and deport them? And remember, if you process people and process people and deport them, you're going to get action from the ACLU and demagoguery from the Democrats regardless. You'll get it on the deportation side after you get it on the, on the capture side, if you want to use that term at present.
I know our immigration policy needs an overhaul, but this doesn't seem the proper way to do it. Former lady Laura Bush wrote a wonderful piece, an op-ed in the Washington Post, where she compared these camps, these converted box stores and tent cities, to Japanese American internment camps of World War II. Inhumane.
Yeah.
And that there's, and Melania Trump released a statement saying, Mrs. Trump hates to see children separated from their families.
Well, who supports
she
that?
She believes we need to be a country that follows all laws, but also a country that governs with a heart.
The sentimentalism is overwhelming.
I want to die if I got separated from my kids.
No one is promoting separating parents from their kids. You're dealing with people who are trying to enter this country illegally, and you're trying to establish border security. And because Democrats are uninterested in border security, as well as even a pathway to a permanent status for those DACA designees that they pretend to care so much about, but because they are uninterested in border security, they're uninterested in ejecting violent criminals who are in this country illegally, who've committed repeated offenses, who have murdered people, and they keep coming back. You know, the rule of law side and the people who play by the rules in this country, they're a little exasperated with the political class, and you wonder why. And so now what we have is this emotion baiting, bigot baiting nonsense, this sentimentalism that suggests that this is the next way that the left can stick us up so we don't have to talk about the four tenets of immigration reform that President Trump has put forward as it pertains to border wall, physical security, as it pertains to ending chain migration, diversity visa lottery, and making it more merit-based. And the McCall Goodlatte legislation also includes an E-Verify provision. So we don't want to talk about that. We can just create emotional ransom and political ransom against Republicans if we demagogue this issue this way. By the way, where were the op-eds from Laura Bush? Where was the virtue signaling from Michael Hayden when children were being kept in exactly the same situation during the previous administration? Kristen Nielsen, the Homeland Security Secretary, properly points out that their policy is an extension of the policy of previous administrations.
So who's to blame for that? President Trump all week long was saying the Democrats, it's their fault.
No, I hate it. I hate the children being taken away. The Democrats have to change their law. That's their law.
I certainly wouldn't sign the more moderate.
What does the bill have to have?
I need a bill that gives this country tremendous border security. I have to have that. We have to get rid of catch and release.
Does that mean the wall?
We have to have the wall. If we don't have the wall, there's no bill.
By the way, just in Europe, it's very interesting to watch socialists get mugged by reality on this topic. You know, France had another attack with a woman shouting Allahu Akbar. And the French National Assembly, not exactly Trumpian, not exactly conservatives, passed a immigration law tightening the rules around asylum in France, shortening the asylum application deadlines, doubling the time for which illegal migrants can be detained, and introducing a one-year prison sentence for entering France illegally. Serve 1 year in jail for entering France illegally.
Well, this leads me to Jorge, Jaime. My mom's gardener just disappeared. He was picked up for a traffic violation, was sent to Eloy for processing for a month, and then deported. Well, we find out he has entered this country 6 times illegally. So they told him, they gave him a Greyhound bus, by the way, back to Nogales, and they said, if you cross this border one more time, you are going to jail for 5 years. So he has a house and a truck and a company in Tucson, Arizona. So now he is going to be living in Nogales and running his company from his home in Nogales.
Mm-hmm. So it is a crime then to cross the border illegally.
Well, he's done it 6 times and now he's not going to be doing it again.
Yeah.
He will not do it again. He can't come and visit his family. He can go visit him.
Right. So then crime and punishment.
But I'm just saying they're making progress. They're if they're pulling people over for different things, they are deporting them.
But other people that come here illegally with children who commit a crime shouldn't be deported. So the guy who sticks up a convenience store, if he says, well, I've got kids, then they shouldn't be separated. He shouldn't go to prison because I got kids.
It's a little different. They're coming here because they're fleeing persecution from their country, or they're trying to escape the drug dealers
in
their neighborhood.
There's an asylum process. And then there's the I want a better life for myself and my family process, which there are hundreds of thousands of people following that process to try and gain entry into this country. But somehow we're supposed to defer to the line jumpers, to the criminals. I mean, it's a criminal act. I appreciate it. I appreciate they want to come to this country. But let's call it what it is so we can have an honest conversation about it.
And with Jeb Bush on this one, it's an act of love.
If the standard is seeking a better life for yourself, then we better clear out some space in our extra bedrooms because you're going to have 5 billion people come to this country.
I will say this, though. If I was thinking about coming here, if I didn't live in this country, I would never cross illegally right now because you risk having your children separated from you. I mean, it's a strong message they're sending. Don't try it.
Ed in Northlake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Laura Bush, I believe this law was enacted under your husband's administration.
Yeah.
It was expanded by the Obama administration, and now it's just purely political motives by the Democrats and another attack on the president to distract from the conversation, as Dan mentioned, about the real issues about reforming immigration. And let me say this. I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and I have a lot of good friends are immigration lawyers because the paths interact because we have to always be cognizant of immigration consequences. 95% of these people aren't fleeing persecution. They are fleeing poverty. And the standard at the border to be eligible for entry with, you know, for asylum, this credible fear, it's laughable. And that people are coached, so that's point one. Point two, Amy, regarding Jaime and the people getting pulled over, average Juan Garcia who gets stopped with no license is not getting referred to immigration court. Your guy, he had previous deportation orders. So when he gets stopped, he gets flagged. ICE has a database on that. And if there's someone who was previously deported and they get stopped by law enforcement, ICE knows about it. And that's how he gets grabbed. And point three, how do we deter people from coming across our border? If they come across knowing and you break the law that you're going to be separated from your children, I think it's a great deterrent. Because U.S. citizens are separated from their children every day in this country when you break the law. So, to me, it's not even a debate. It's purely political, and there were no Democrats screaming up and down during Obama's administration when this was going on.
Thanks for the call, Ed. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Ed.
Good stuff. Megan on the South Side.
Hi, guys. Good morning. I just wanted to say, you know, Dan, you had mentioned something about the Holocaust earlier. I could be wrong, but didn't we, you know, not allow Holocaust survivors in the country? I'm not saying that was the right thing to do. But a lot of people are trying to compare the two. So that's
yes, actually, it's a good history lesson. The sainted to the left, FDR, left 1,000 Jews fleeing Nazi persecution out in the harbor in Havana after the Cubans refused entry. They sought asylum in the United States. They were denied. Didn't even get a response from FDR. So, yeah, you might want to raise that with your friends when they want to make the Nazi comparisons, I guess. If it's anything, it's more like the FDR comparison to Trump, but it's not even a very good comparison there because they were literally seeking or legitimately seeking asylum, and they weren't allowed even to try and process in. They were just ignored, where at least these individuals coming over here illegally or legally through standard ports of entry are receiving an assessment in terms of their qualification for asylum. And, oh, by the way, very few of them are, if any, are fleeing anything like Nazi Germany. So
exactly.
Very good history lesson, Megan. Thank you for that. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. If the bigger crime now is separating children from the criminal adults who are committing the crimes, why don't we get back to the olden days where entire families were locked up? I don't think that's what people are advocating. Mm. So I think it's interesting that it's convenient to scream about separation of families when it suits a political purpose. But when everyday crimes break up and destroy families because of criminal behavior, you know, we don't hear about those people getting crammed into the cells with their fathers and mothers who are committing crimes and who are locked up all the time.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Well, here's the other thing, too. When you want to do like a one-off policy because it appeals to your emotions, like in this case here, what about the one-off policy the Democrats won't do on DACA? What about that? 800,000 kids, Trump saying, no, I'll raise you $1.8 million to all those who were eligible and didn't seek that DACA status for permanent status.
And the Democrats still won't budge.
They won't do it.
Even when Obama was in power or in charge and he had the House right. and the Senate on his side, they still always danced around immigration and getting something done.
Because these other human beings are mascots for the left. That's all they are. Mascots. The means to political gamesmanship. Marty in Naperville.
Hi, good show, Amy. I got to ask you, you would die before you'd separate your kids from your kids. These people, who are these people doing this? What kind of a person knows? And don't tell me they don't know that this is going to happen. And as one of the callers said before, or as Dan said also, you know, well, you can't arrest me. I've got children. That's what this is all about. Nobody wants to blame, say, give any, everything is Donald Trump and the Republicans' fault on this. You know, nothing is being said about these parents who are actually putting their kids in this position.
Thanks, Marty.
I would never put my kids in that position.
They may have to if you continue assaulting Uber drivers. You may be separated. Sean and Elmwood
Park. If they're 4 and younger, put them with their mom and dad. Come on.
In prison?
4.98. That's all I got to say, Amy. Listen, and don't worry about your mother's landscaper. I got a cigar that says he'll be able to hand deliver the June bill. Here's the thing that I wanted to say on Sunday shows.
If he comes back,
Sunday shows are all the Democrat apparatchiks, all the socialists and communists. What would God do? Did you hear what the Pope said? Have you no religion? Now they want to mention religion. But what all the moms that are on their way to Planned Parenthood to dismember their babies this morning, I get the bill for that. Right? I got that's okay to separate the mothers from the babies there. But when they make the decision as adults to risk what they know is wrong and what they know could happen, then I got to get the bill for that, too. I'm pro-choice. I'm the immigrant deciding to risk separation from his kid. What do you think about that? We got to start using their language. I'm pro-choice on the decision of the immigrant to risk losing the kid. There you go. Just give me the bill either way. I got it.
Thanks, Sean.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Over the weekend, Steve Bannon made an appearance. He popped up on This Week, sat down for an interview with Jonathan Carl, and made a bold prediction about the midterms, even though he doesn't speak to Trump any longer. He doesn't need to.
The president, of course, you alluded to it, called you sloppy Steve. He said that when you got fired, you not only lost your job, you lost your mind.
Right.
Have you patched things up with the president? When was the last time you spoke to him?
By the way, before I stepped in as CEO of the campaign, I probably talked to Donald Trump 10 times in my entire life. Yeah. Okay? I don't need to talk to Donald Trump. Donald Trump... Donald Trump is accomplishing everything he committed to the American people on the campaign that I stepped in as CEO. I couldn't be prouder of the guy. All he's got to do is continue to hit those marks on that whiteboard, and he's going to run the tables. You're not going to do an immigration bill from weakness.
Are you talking to him, though, or are you?
No.
No.
By the way, I talk day through the press and through the media. By the way, he's got too many guys he talks to right now. All he's got to do is listen to his own inner voice, and that's going to lead... Write this down. That's going to lead to a astounding victory in November. He is going to run the tables in the House.
I don't know. I don't think he's over him yet. I mean, I think there's a little...
Well, he's pretty excited about the performance so far, though. He just needs to listen to his inner self and continue doing what he's doing. And he's going to confound the critics and the naysayers yet again. For more on this topic, we'll see if he agrees. We're pleased to be joined again by our friend, Sam Scott Adams, who is, of course, the Dilbert cartoon creator and the Trump whisperer. He's the author of the book Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. Scott, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think about Bannon's bold prediction there?
Well, I've predicted that the midterms will be better for the Republicans than whatever anybody thought at the start of this year. But whether or not they run the table, that does seem like a bold prediction. Not impossible, but I'd say that's a stretch goal at this point.
I mean, in terms of just you'll run the table, it's, I don't know exactly what Bannon meant there. I think he just meant keep the House. Are you willing to make that bold a prediction? And if so, why?
You know, I think you have to be sort of a closer to the individual races, because there's a lot that has to do with, you know, the matchups and the individual situations. And I think I would just go with the experts that there's always an impulse for the party out of power to pick up some seats. But, man, they're swimming upstream against a lot of success from this president. So I would expect something closer to no change than a sea change.
Now, recently, it seems like it was a long time ago, but it was just last week that President Trump made history when he sat down with Kim Jong-un, and they played this video from Destiny Productions that's saying what life would be like in North Korea if they just denuclearized. And you said it was quite possibly the best thing you've ever seen. Can you further explain why?
Yeah, the basic problem that people made when looking at it is to assume that they individually were the audience. And the audience was just one person. There was only one person in the world who mattered. And presumably they looked into what kinds of images, what kinds of presentation would be culturally and individually effective. Now, when I looked at it, the actual construction of the video looked so amazingly well done mm-hmm. in terms of being persuasive in a positive way, meaning encouraging North Korea to see the two options, the horrible one of war and the really good one, being our friend. And so I think it really went a long way, especially because there's a language barrier between the president and Kim Jong-un. So to turn that visual and make it unforgettable, I think was a very effective thing to do, even if it looked corny to our jaded Western eyes.
Yes, exactly. So I'm one of those with jaded Western eyes. I thought it was just sort of, it's interesting, but I just found it, isn't it overly simplistic when you're talking about the geopolitics of a nuclear North Korea?
Nope. One of the interesting things about persuasion is that somebody can see exactly what you're doing and it still works. And that's the reason that all marketing works. It's the reason that all salesmanship works. When you go into the car dealer, you are fully aware of every trick they're using, and it still works. You know, when you look at any company marketing, you say, "Oh, look what they're doing! I know what they're trying to manipulate me," and it still works. So this is another one of those cases. The visual images are so powerful that they just push other things out of your head, and this was super visual. It hit every note that they needed to hit. So even if it looked like it was way over the top, that doesn't have any effect on its how useful it is. Mm-hmm. So our reaction to it is wholly different from how effective it is.
Yeah, and I honestly think that Kim Jong-un, you know, President Trump said that when they played it on the iPad for him, his eyes lit up and he seemed receptive. Because I think he wants his country in a way to be Americanized, to have the water parks and the...
And he wants to go to Disneyland.
Well, they showed an impossible amusement park and, you know, an automotive manufacturing line for cars and computers, because there's a lot there, and then not to mention the oceanfront property.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest story was the one that's unreported, which is people are saying, hey, the president left there without anything and we gave up, you know, the war games, or we gave up giving him the meeting that he got a lot of respect. And I think the biggest story is missing, which is the president went there with Kim Jong-un having something like a reason to nuke us. And when he left, there was no reason anymore. He took away the reason. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're worried about how it goes from here, I would say it's pretty good news that North Korea no longer has a reason. And if we continue to not act aggressive toward them, I would expect we'll get a good result. You know, it's going to be a bumpy road. We would expect that they may not be 100% forthcoming, but if we keep at it, and at the same time, there's just no reason for them to see us as an enemy. And that video went a long way towards saying, look, being our friend is a really good deal, and here's the offer. We'd rather be friends. That's a really powerful message. And taking the reason away from a country, I don't know we've ever seen that before, have we?
Not quite in that way. Not with a video. Not with a movie trailer. We haven't seen
in a
it
world
before.
Gone mad.
Let me ask you.
I'm sorry. But take for example Iran. If we tried to take away their reason, we couldn't, because you know they may have deep-seated hatred for Israel and maybe religious motivations. But North Korea was unique. It was a psychological problem where they thought we wanted to attack them. We thought they wanted to attack us, and the best psychological operator in the world, that's what I call Trump, went in and solved a problem that was almost designed for him. It was like he was born for that problem. It was purely psychological, and he just removed it. And the parts that happened after this, of course, are hard and unknown, the actual removal of the weapons. But he did the tough part, which is he changed minds, I'm sure.
What about on the psychological front in terms of shifting the balance of power or leverage with respect to that Inspector General report on Friday? Kind of good news, bad news. The bad news is it confirms that you had sort of political operatives masquerading as leaders in the FBI and the Department of Justice. The good news is that it vindicates a lot of what Trump has done so far and said about the senior leadership of both of those agencies, and gives him, frankly, newfound standing, I believe.
Well, I would put, there's several things I would lump together. The OIG report, climate change, trade agreements, and a few other things. And they have this quality where they're complicated enough and the public doesn't really understand all of the variables that it allows them to see whatever the heck they wanted to see, you know, ahead of time. So when you're seeing the two reactions to the OIG report from, oh, it vindicates the president entirely to, well, no, that was a big nothing. There's nothing there. It didn't change a thing. And I kind of felt the latter. I felt like it did give us a sense of the feelings that the FBI people had, but I'm not sure that was any different than we imagined. So it seemed like a lot changed.
But, I mean, it's one thing for people in a partisan context to be saying it. It's another thing for a 568-page report from someone who is perceived and I think respected from both sides as independent in the Michael Horowitz, the inspector general, to provide the painstaking details that support what we kind of already suspected was true.
Yeah, it gives you some comfort that you understand the situation, but there's still enough you know, gray there that people can see it any way they want. So I'm not sure it moved the needle in any direction at all, but it did help us understand that we know what people were thinking at the time.
Wanted to get your take on what's going on right now along our borders in El Paso and Brownsville, Texas, children being separated from their families. President Trump's blaming the Democrats. Democrats are blaming President Trump. Is this just another way for Democrats to pile on to President Trump, or do you think he should change the zero tolerance policy?
Well, on the political level, it's just a home run for the anti-Trump team, and it's a disaster for the Trump administration. So there's no question about who's winning the political part of that right now. But there is a big part in the reality part. There's a lot of magical thinking going on because nobody wants to deal with the central issue, which is if you make things really comfortable for people coming in, there will be more of them. Now, that's the point that should be debated because the objective from all sides, I believe, is to have less of what we're seeing, you know, fewer people in the so-called cages, fewer people coming across in dire straits. But the real issue is if you make it easy for everybody in the short run, which our humanitarian impulses are all really in the same side. There's nobody on the other side. Nobody wants kids in cages. Nobody wants children separated from adults unless there's just no other choice. And when you see this debate, it looks like a phony debate to me because nobody is laying out the alternative case, which is, all right, let's let people go, or do they push them across the border as a family? I don't believe anybody has even described what the alternative is and also connected the dots to, if we do this, what's that look like in the long run? Does it make it worse or better? Do we encourage more people to come up here or not? And until you've dealt with it on sort of an adult level, I don't know how you can get any help. But let me say as clearly as possible, this is a complete breakdown of government effectiveness that is both Democrats and Republicans and the White House. This is a complete, you know, breakdown, not just in the political sense, but in the reality sense that we're having this conversation and nobody is talking about it like an adult.
Well.
We haven't even gotten to the adult level of conversation about this. It's just children in cages. And guess what? 100% of the people are on the same side of that. Nobody wants that. That part is horrible.
Yeah, but so this is longstanding. And to your point before about marketing working, I know what you're doing, but it works anyway. Emotional manipulation here, and you know, there's a reason we've been on this hamster wheel on immigration for so long. Is that certainly the left in this case, and sometimes Republicans as well, are more interested in using people as mascots for particular political gain than they are in addressing, you know, a structural infirmity in a system.
Yeah, I've suggested, at least as an idea, one way to make things a little bit better and fairly quickly, which is if there's some way to electronically connect the parents to the kids, so at least they could talk to them or see them. And that might be a case of, you know, a few iPads in the right places, because there are probably maybe fewer than 10 facilities where the kids and the adults might be. Mm. So, you know, 20 iPads or something in that nature would get everybody a chance to at least see that their child is well cared for, that parents can see the adults. They can say, hey, we'll see you. We hope to see you in a few days or whatever it turns out to be. So there's a psychological part of this that's the bad part, which is wholly separate from the fact that people are, you know, their freedom is taken away temporarily and they're in these big cage-like containers. And by the way, the cage part is mostly just the first part where they're taken from the dangerous trip, which is bad enough. You know, the getting here is dangerous and had to be horrible. To they put them in temporary facilities, which are more cage-like in the sense that it's like a mass prison. But the idea is to get them out of there as quickly as possible to separate the adults and the men and the women and whatever you have to do for safety.
Right.
So all the fine people who are doing these jobs, who I hear are just great professionals with all the right intentions, they've got a tough job. And there's no right way to do this that the public is also going to be happy with, given the facilities that they have. So certainly, I'd love to hear a better idea. I think we could immediately get the parents in better conversations or more frequent contact with the kids, and especially seeing them. I don't think a phone call quite does it. But there might be some ways to immediately make it easier. But who has the better idea about the short-term fix that doesn't make it worse in the long term? And who can even say those two things out loud? And who else besides me said what I just said, which is the short-term fix might make the long-term worse? How do we get a short-term fix that doesn't make it worse?
Mm-hmm.
Who's even asking that question? I mean, doesn't that outrage you that our government is so ineffective that neither side is even giving us the adult version of what's going on?
No, that's right. Actually, we've asked that question and debated it around on this show many times, including earlier in the show. But that is the right question, and it's an interesting idea with the iPads. That seems perfectly sensible to me. Scott Adams, Dilbert cartoon creator and Trump whisperer, author of the book Win Bigly, Persuasion in a World Where Facts Don't Matter. Scott, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.